All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Let me check here. Looks like we've got quite a few questions right now, but there might still be room for more. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic, anything you want to talk about, press 1 on your phone right now. We might be able to get to you. We are we're going to get started here.
Your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. We can talk about anything you want to talk about. Pick up the phone, ask a question. I'll do my best to get you an answer. And we are going to jump right into the phone calls today and see what it is you want to talk about. We're starting off in Oklahoma. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
Good. What can I help you with today?
I've got an oil sample I'd like to get you to look at. And also, I called you a few weeks ago about this 03 Columbia that I was hitting a bump. And the motor was dying, and, you know, lose all power and everything. Got that fixed. Turns out it was a ground cable that goes from the battery box to the chassis.
Okay.
Got that fixed. It's all sorted out. Spent a couple $1,000s at a couple different shops and come to find out it's a, you know, 12-cent bolt. But anyways, I've still got a problem with this truck. When I first take off, it and I set the cruise on 65. It's governed at 65. My speedometer on my dash will read about 60, but this daggone thing will run all the way up to about 71 miles an hour as per my Qualcomm gauge and my Rand McNally. I got a T&D tablet, and they both read accurately at about 70, 71, and my speedometer only says about 60, and it does that for about 15 or 20 minutes. Until, I guess, I don't know, something warms up or a connection gets completely made, or I'm at a loss trying to figure it out. I checked my the speed sensor in the tail, in the tail shaft of the transmission, like you told me to, and it was fine, and put it on an ohm meter, and everything read like it was supposed to, and I'm not real sure where to go to next.
Wow. Ooh, that's a tough one. It's almost always that speed sensor starts to get worn out. And
that looked like a pretty simple little thing. It was just a
one 10 millimeter
bolt, and the cap pulled it right out, had a
right.
O-ring on it. And, I mean, it didn't have any marks on it, like it was hitting anything. I'm lost.
Huh. Yeah, I'm a little lost after that, too. The other place it could be is at the exact other end of the spectrum, which is the speedometer head itself.
Speedometer in the dash?
Yeah.
Would that give, like, make the computer think it's not going as fast as it is or something?
It,
I thought the computer
can, yeah.
Give a reading to it.
Well, and that's what we have, you know, sometimes we have a purely mechanical connection. Sometimes we have an electronic connection. Sometimes we have a combination of both. And so normally when we try to troubleshoot these, we start with the easiest thing, which is the speed sensor. The next one, though, would be the physical head of the speedometer itself.
All right. Well, I've got a parts truck. I'll just pull one out of it, throw in there, and see if it cures it.
That's wonderful. That's the easiest and cheapest way to troubleshoot.
Groovy. And another thing on this truck, it happened again. I bought my fourth fleet air filter, and again, it worked again. like bolted on 4.5 tenths again. $350 gives you 4.5 tenths fuel mileage. It's
excellent.
Crazy to me. I don't understand it.
Excellent.
So yeah, those
yeah,
things
we,
work.
We, good. Money, good. Fella. I love to hear that. That's right. That's right. Go make some money. You just have to spend some to do it.
There you go. It's not hard. It's not rocket surgery.
That's right. Good stuff.
But,
so we're looking at an oil sample?
Yes, sir.
Am I supposed to have the oil sample here?
I believe so. The lady I spoke with on the phone said you was able to look that up. She didn't have a password or something.
Oh, okay. I can't then.
You need to put me on hold?
I do, and we may not be able to get to that today. Normally, Lisa does all of that. She pulls up all the results, sends it to me. Brittany is screening calls today, and she does a wonderful job, but we forgot about getting her access to the oil sample data. So we might have to do that one another day. Let's go to Baltimore. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Good to talk to you.
What's on your mind today?
I'm in a, after watching this and to your show, I've been getting the bug to want to go do it on my own, and I'm actually in a weird position. I have a company job that pays me very well. I do six figures. I don't really run the road. I mean, they do keep me out four nights a week, and I stay in a hotel. So I'm at the position where I have to, you know, to do it, I want to make the numbers work to be close to what I'm making now if I'm going to do this. I don't want to take on a job and basically pay to work it, you know, if you understand what I'm trying to say, you know.
I do. Yeah.
I've actually come across a couple situations. One of our guys had left the company and went to go run propane. I'm in the chemical business, so that's probably why I make pretty good money. Seems to be the industry that pays pretty well. Now I ran into one of the owner-operators at his company, and we got talking, and he started throwing some numbers out there, and we got together, and I picked his brain. I bought him breakfast one day and picked his brain for a couple of hours and got every number I could get out of him, and seen some settlement sheets. I didn't see his profit and loss. And it all looked good. And I spoke to a couple other people from the company, and it all sounded great. Applied for the company, and I've been driving 28 years, but for the last six, my company has 10-wheelers. And for the last four, I've been in a 10-wheeler. So when the lady called me from Texas, we got to speaking, and she says, well, looking at your application, I'm sorry, but we're really up on safety, and that's a high priority with the company, and you haven't been in a tractor trailer for the last 4 years. I said, well, I've been driving 28 years, and I do get in a tractor trailer occasionally. They take me
right
to other locations. So that's where I'm at with that one. So, I said, I can't tell you to hire. I mean, that's your choice. Then I came across and this is all I want to ask you. Maybe you have an answer, maybe somebody else does. Came across another outfit. I've been doing my search, and it was a gasoline hauling company, and I just figured it'd be good for me. I could be home every day. So they threw out a number of what their average settlements were, and I did my budget. I put in all my numbers, what I thought it was going to cost me for a truck, and I could go back as old as I wanted as long as it has an electronic motor. It all worked out to be great on paper. So I ran it.
Okay.
I wanted to go see I wanted to find one of their fleet. You could grow a fleet with them. They're behind you on that.
Yeah.
So I ran into one of their fleet. Well, I actually stopped by one of their fleet owners' shops. Got to talking to them, and the numbers were off by like $1,000 a week. So I don't know if he was just throwing a low ball number out there to me, or if they're just not being honest with me about what their average is. It just
I would tend, and this isn't a slam dunk, because sometimes the guys who are already there don't want more competition and they will scare people away. So that's a possibility too. We do know that the fleets are going to exaggerate their numbers. The fleet, when they're talking to you, they're going to give you, I'm not going to say they're going to outright lie. They might. But at least we know they're going to give you best case scenario. Not an average,
right.
Not, you know, what's potential the first year. They're going to give you best case. So if
right.
we think the fleet is exaggerating in one direction, and maybe the you know, guy who contracts to him is exaggerating in the other direction, if we split the number, would you still be okay?
Even at that number, I would be just a hair below what I'm making now. I'd be making a little less. And
let me ask you this question. Let me ask you this question. Because one of the things, and, you know, just take this as good constructive advice and don't take it personally, but one of the things I've found over the years is that when somebody is thinking about getting into business and number that they're going to make is their number one focus, it usually doesn't work well. You know,
for me,
and I know people have a hard time understanding this, when I start a new business, a new project, whatever, money is not even top five on my list. I mean, we've been running our podcast network for over a year now, and it is nothing but a big drain on resources. We don't make a penny off that thing. And, you know, the rest of the company, they're always wondering, when are you going to try to make some money with this? And I'm like, it's just not what I'm focused on now. You know, again, I can afford to do that because the rest of the business is doing well, but I did that when I had no money. We were spending all our money developing software, and there was no real return on investment for several years. So think about that. I'm going to come back to you right after this break. Stick around. I'm Kevin Roth. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm talking with Gary in Baltimore. So, Gary, I want you to think about that a little bit. And here's a question I would ask. And we can never know any of these numbers. That's part of the problem. But let's say I told you I've looked at all the numbers, I've looked at all the potential, and I can almost guarantee that in the first 3 years, you're going to make 20% less than what you used to make. But if you stick with it, if you do all the right stuff, if things go well, after that you're going to make 5% more than what you used to make, and then that's probably going to be the limit. If we could guarantee those numbers, would you still be okay and would you go do this?
Oh, yeah, I would. Because I, for the last 6 years, I've been putting in about 17, 18% into my 401k. And
okay, good.
I would just look like, you know, I'm not going to contribute to 401k for that time frame.
So
until I can
so financially you could handle it, and that's a good thing, because some people come to me and say, "Oh no, my God, if I make 20% less, I'll have to file bankruptcy because they're spending every penny they're making right now." So that's an absolute no, you can't do it. You can afford it. You've got the finances to do it. Then what it comes down to really is your mental attitude. Are you willing to work harder for 20% less?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. And that's good, because once you – so then, you know, we can at least start looking at, you know, the other if I were you, I would go into this – leaning more towards the fact that the guy who is a contractor with them is probably closer to the real number. But if we split it down the middle, that would probably be a pretty safe bet too. The other thing you have to remember, though, no matter how good we are, no matter how smart we are, no matter how much homework we do, no matter how much we think we're prepared, if somebody who has been contracting with that company can make $100,000 a year, you shouldn't count on making any more than 75 the first year, because you've got to learn the system. You've got to build relationships. There's so many little things that we can't really put on paper, but we know they exist.
Right. Well, I thank you for all your help in this, and I was along those lines, thinking along those lines. I just wanted to hear from somebody else. Yeah.
Yep. No, so, I think you're on the right track, and I think you're being realistic about this. And the good news is that you have the financial ability to make this work. So here's what I would say. I would give it a shot. I would go for it, because worst case scenario, even if it doesn't work out and you don't like it, you go back to, you know, doing it as an employee, to me, better than always wondering the rest of your life what would have happened if I would have tried it. So I think you've got a strong enough financial background, you've got enough interest, you're willing to work for less for a while, and then that creates the opportunity to make more. And I think for you, if you don't do this, you're always going to wonder what would happen if I would have done it. Let's go to Georgia. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I had a couple questions. I don't know if you've seen on the news the past couple of days, the big headline has been about red meat and processed meat and how it's causing problems. And on the road here, I like to eat a lot of bratwurst and, ribeye steaks and whatnot. And I was just going to basically get your opinion on the studies, see if you had actually researched them and what you thought, and if things like no nitrate bacon and the grass-fed beef would alleviate some of these issues that you have with these
plants. So let's start with the whole red meat scare just in general. Shouldn't eat red meat. It's not healthy. It causes heart disease. It causes cancer. Well, let's put some logic to that. And people around the world have been eating red meat for thousands of years. That's what we survived on for centuries. So red meat itself is an extremely healthy food source. Let's just start there. It doesn't cause cancer. It doesn't cause heart disease. It has all kinds of nutrition. It is one of our natural foods, so it can't be bad in and of itself. Now, it is the way we raise those animals today. It's the way we process those animals. That is, if anything, and there's no real concrete proof either, that even the way we raise the animals today is causing a problem. I think it does, but I couldn't prove that to you, and these studies don't prove it. These studies don't even come close to proving it. It all depends on how the media wants to portray these stories. And that's really the problem. We don't have any proof that even our lousy meat today is causing any problems. There's a good chance it could be, but we don't have absolute proof. So I am not stopping eating red meat. I'm not going to stop eating bacon or sausage or any of those things. I am going to work hard to seek out the best source of those meats that I can find as often as possible. That doesn't mean I'm not going to go to a Waffle House and get bacon and eggs. I will, and I know they're probably getting me the worst bacon possible, but you know what? I'm not eating it every day, and I will seek out best source as often as I can. You know, I'll order in, and I don't see any true correlation between nitrates and any problem. Nitrates exist in nature. Nitrates exist in celery. And, you know, even the nitrate-free meats aren't truly nitrate-free. If you read the label, it says no nitrates except naturally occurring. So there's nitrates in it. They just come from the celery juice or some other things that they use when they don't use nitrates. So I'm not at all convinced about the nitrate thing. I do buy some nitrate-free bacon, but I also buy bacon that is processed and has nitrates. I try to get grass-fed beef and pastured pork and pastured chicken as often as I can, but I'll tell you, at least once a week, I probably buy a rotisserie chicken from the grocery store, because it's convenient.
Okay,
so
great. Yeah.
We're far better off eating, no matter what the meat is, unless it's totally, totally processed cheap bologna or something like that. I mean, that's probably going to an extreme. But if we're eating a steak, for example, a steak hasn't been processed. So even if it came from a factory farm where we know it didn't have the best diet, one whole food with one ingredient, that has to be way better than eating something processed and packaged.
Okay, great. Yeah, someone was saying that it seemed like they just need something to talk about, and so they dug that up.
They do.
That makes
it
a lot better, and I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's great. Also, I had a question about the RV. I was wondering how that was doing, and basically your recommendations on, I know if you're going to get a diesel one, get a pre-08, you know, no DPF, but I just wanted to know what your recommendations were on the market, since you did a lot of research here recently before you bought yours. And if you're going to be doing about 4 weeks a year family vacation, is it better just to rent or to look for a good used one?
Boy, that is such a – let's start with that question, because that is such a tough call. The price of renting an RV, in my opinion, is outrageously expensive. And so it's hard to justify. I've looked at it before we had ours. I looked at it a couple times, and I'm like, my God. You know, part of the problem was I knew I was going out to buy one. So for me, the only advantage to renting one was just to learn it, to see what I like, to spend some time in it. And when I looked at the cost, I thought, my God, I would rather just take that money and go buy one and take my chances, you know, and I'll learn as I go. Yeah, because you go spend $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 sometimes to rent one of these things to go on vacation. I mean,
it is really,
depending on the size and how long, it can be really expensive. And I thought, once I do that, the money's gone. I have nothing for it. I just rather keep that money, you know. And the first one we bought, dirt cheap. We bought a really old, you know, Class A. It was a diesel pusher. It was pretty good size, but it was old. And I knew we were going to have problems with it, but I thought, I'll go buy this. We'll run it around for a couple months, and then I'll sell it. And that's way cheaper than trying to rent one. And that way I'll learn, do I like it, you know, what kind of things do I want, what don't I want. And then we went from the Class A, we did our trailer, and, you know, after 5 years of the trailer, we realized I wanted the Class A again. Because we work in that thing, this year we're probably going to be in it for a full 6 months. We're leaving in January sometime, and we won't be back till after the CMC. So
are you a fan
us,
of the old GMC?
Oh, hold on a second. We're going to get to a break. We'll come right back to this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking with Mark in Georgia. So, Mark, we're back. What was that question?
Well, I was just going to see if you were a fan of the old GMCs, you know, the front-wheel drive-based, front auto-based ones. I know they have a big cult following, and I wasn't sure what you thought of the old GM motorhomes.
You know, I kind of love that style. David Counts from Fleet Air Filters does a lot of RV business, repair, bodywork, paint. They build some stuff down there. And one of the guys he had working down there was also an engineer, and he was into those, and he bought one and was totally reconditioning it. And they're just so unique. They're pretty cool. If that's what you're into, restoring and reconditioning, and you want to do that, I think those are very cool. For me, because we work so much, and when we're on the road, our time is tight. You know, we've got to work, we've got to do the show, we've got to get some miles. I can't be screwing around. The one thing I will tell you about RVs, no matter how much you spend on one, you're always working on something. There's always that they're so complicated. You know, there's three different electrical systems. There's a couple different plumbing systems. There's hookups. There's generators. There's inverters. There's switches. There's it just on and on and on. So there's always something that you're doing. Now, the older you go, the more often you're doing that kind of stuff. You've got slide systems and have any slides, so you at least get away from that. There's just so much going on. And then on top of that, I have my electronics and my internet connection and my radio stuff. So I stay busy working on stuff all the time. And when you're on the road, you've only got so much time to do that. So for me, we were, because it's also a tax write-off for me, we absolutely have to have it for business. We, you know, spend a lot of time in it. I spent way, way more than I ever would if this was just something that I went on vacation, you know, a couple weeks out of the year. So I could justify a much bigger budget. So I'm on the higher end of the diesel pushers, not at the top, but we're at the higher end. Just because I needed that, the business pays for most of it, it's a tax write-off, and we spend a lot of time in it. But if I were just going out, goofing around and doing a vacation here and there, running down to the lake for the weekend, one of those older, you know, restored, that would be fun. If you're into that, that would be a fun way to go. And the other thing is you can start cheap and do more and more over time.
Okay, great. Sounds good. I certainly do appreciate it. Just from real quick, from the look to the market, when you were doing your research, what year seems to be the best matchup of depreciation and value, would you say, early 2000s? Or?
Well, for me, and we were looking at a country, and this is very model specific, and I'll tell you why. We were looking at a country coach. One, I love the fact right. that they were built here in Oregon. They are, you know, at the higher end of the diesel pushers. So we had settled on, we're going to buy a country coach. And I came down to one absolute year. And the reason was from 2006 to 2007, country coach did kind of a huge technology upgrade in what was available as far as all the switching, all the electronic controls. They came out with a full electric package that didn't use any propane for anything at all, and that was a big advantage for me. Then in 2008, they didn't really upgrade any of the RV technology much, but they had to go to the DPF, just like we did.
Right.
So I absolutely didn't want an 08 because of the DPF, and I didn't want the 06 because of the older technology. So for me, I was looking very, very specific. I wanted an 07 country coach. The other thing is about 90% of them had Cummins, and I did not want an ISX. So I was looking for an 07 country coach only with a cat, and we found one. But that's how narrow I had mine down. Now, if you're not too worried about, you know, the upgraded electronics and all that stuff, I would be looking back at an 03 just to get away from the emissions completely.
Exactly. Okay, great. Well, hey, that's great. I feel like this might be a good time of the year to start looking with the winter coming up. And I sure do appreciate your time as always. Thank you much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. And depreciation is a huge factor. Just to give you a rough idea percentage-wise, on an 07 with about 50,000 miles, which is nothing. These are, you know, 13-liter diesel engines that'll run a million miles. With 50,000 miles on an 07, we paid less than, let me make sure I'm doing this right, less than one-third of the original price of the vehicle. 1/3, and it's only got 50,000 miles on it. So, yeah, unless you're just rolling in money, I can't imagine buying a new one. They depreciate so horribly in the first 5 years. Let's go to Chicago. John, welcome to the program.
Hello. I found a good use for Facebook. There is a group page out there, and it is called Big Rig Truck Parts. I'm trying to remember to get this right. Big Rig Truck Parts Sell and Swap.
Okay.
It's a group that people are posting their trucks for sale and headache racks, toolboxes, and all that stuff on there. There is quite a few of the older pre-emission trucks on there right now. I just wanted to pass the word on for people who are looking for trucks. I mean, there's one 2001 387 Pete with a Cummins in it for sale on there, and there's just all sorts of older trucks, and there was an older cab over Pete on there a couple weeks ago, and I just figured I'd pass on the word to everybody.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a great resource.
And that's all I have for you today, Kevin.
All right. Thanks. I appreciate it. That's all I need right now. Let's see. We can get to another one here. We're off to Florida. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I have a question about an IRA. The guy that does my taxes, he always pushes and pushes and pushes. He wants me to open up an IRA. And for some strange reason, you know, he wants me to do that. But for some strange reason, I think if I go to put all this money into IRA, you know, they got all these scams out. I just think, what if a freak accident happened? You know, 15 years I've been putting money into this, and I die. And I've been up some money, and then who gets the money?
Okay, so that's a really, really good question that a lot of people never ask. But the good news is we don't have to guess. We don't have to worry. There are ways to be very, very specific about who does get the money. And it's good that you're asking, because once you take care of that up front, then you don't ever have to worry about it again. So let me ask you this. If you were putting money in and you had all this money there and you died, who would you want to get the money?
My daughter. But she's six right now, so yeah, my daughter. My only child.
So, and that's still very easy to do. And, well, I say easy, but we don't have to worry about it. There is a way to absolutely guarantee that if you died, she would get the money. And it's ironclad. No scams, no nothing. You would use a certified financial planner, and you can look those up and find one local and go talk to them, make sure you're comfortable with them. And what they will do is they will create, well, there's a couple ways. They may have some other ideas that they like using, but if it's a CFP, you can trust them. You go to them, you say, here's what I want to do. Here's how I want it to be set up, and they'll give you some options. But if it were me when I were practicing, I would have had you open the IRA in a trust. Now, there's a really, really simple way to do this. Right on the IRA form, one of the questions they ask you is, who do you want to be your beneficiary? And it doesn't even have to be one person. You can have multiples. You can say, I want 25% to go to this person, 50% to go to this person, however you want to do it. Now, because it's a minor... Because it's a minor, if it were your brother, your wife, or somebody, an adult, it'd be easy. You'd just put the name on the form. Because it's a minor, I would recommend setting up a trust. So if you die, the money goes to the trust. The trust handles the money until your daughter becomes an adult, but it can use some of the money for her benefit, for schooling or health care, whatever you want. But the good news is we don't have to worry about a scam. We don't have to worry about, you know, is it – it's very legal. It happens all the time, and we can determine all this up front, and then you don't have to worry about it. I'm going to get to a break. I'm going to come back to you right after this and make sure we got you the answer you need. Stick around. Kevin Roth. All right, a quick heads up. We are heading into the final segment of the first hour. And when I'm done at the end of the segment, I say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. I've got to get out of here. Don't hang up. We're going to come back and do another hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get back to the phone calls. I was talking with Jonathan in Florida. So, Jonathan, if you work with somebody like a CFP, a certified financial planner, which is what I used to be,
okay,
you can trust them. You tell them what you want to happen, and there are very clear legal ways to make that happen, and then you really don't have to worry about it.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking, yeah, I do own some debt-free, real estate free and clear. You know, like with real estate, you know, if you die, you know, nobody's not going to take that away. And so long you paying the property tax, and, you know, nobody's just not going to take that away from you.
And that's the same way here.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's the same way. This is a legal account. The money is yours, and you get to determine what you want to have done with it. Now, the one thing I want to warn people about is even if you do nothing, even if you don't determine what you want done, it's still going to go to your heirs. The problem is it has to go through what's called probate, and that just complicates everything. What that means is if you die and you don't have a will and you haven't set up the trust and done all this stuff, then all of your assets go into probate. Probate goes in front of a judge, and the judge uses the law to determine who's going to get what. It will still go to your heirs, but you don't get to decide how it goes. The law gets to decide how it goes to them, whereas if
okay,
you set it up up front, you get to determine all those choices.
Okay. All right, Kevin, thanks a lot. I'll get back with my tech guy, and I guess I'll get that started.
There you go. Good stuff. And congratulations on doing some planning, you know, getting this started. That's a great thing. Let's go to Gordon in Canada. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. First time caller, long time listener. Okay, thanks. I'll just describe my truck. It's an 08 W900, 600 ISX. I got a Duralite charger, cooler, and I use X-Multi Energy Energy D drive tires and XZ-A3 Plus steering tires. I got 1.48 million kilometers. Yeah, 1.48 million kilometers on it. I've used Shell Vitella 1540 since the truck was new. It's pulled heavy weights all the way through. Super B's, my empty weight is about 68,000 pounds, and my loaded weight's about just over 139,000. And the oil
okay,
has changed about every... Yeah, the oil was changed about every 20,000 kilometers, and I never had to add any oil between the changes. So it's had a spinner bypass, two filter on it since about 800,000 kilometers, and I was having trouble with the EGR and the DPF, so I deleted it at 1.25 million, and I still have the program for the VGT turbo on it, so that still works. I bought an OPS EcoPure, and I want to put it on, providing I can find enough room for it because I want to keep the spinner. And
okay,
I called Pittsburgh Power and just wanted to talk to them about if the filter life would be extended now because of the spinner 2 and the OPS. But they told me that Cummins has spent a lot of money researching synthetic oil, and they're recommending under no circumstances to use synthetic oil in their engines. Now, I've got the T6 in here now. I've got about 12,000 kilometers on this oil. It hasn't gone down or anything, and I'm just I can't find nothing wrong with it. I'm just surprised how they would recommend something like that.
Yeah, because the other engine manufacturers are the exact opposite. I mean, Detroit clearly says that synthetic is a superior oil, and they recommend it.
Oh, for sure.
Most engine manufacturers have known that for years. Cummins, anymore for the last 10 years, I sit back and scratch my head and think, what happened to this company that was so wonderful for so many years? I don't understand half of what they do anymore. All I can get is that they are having so many problems with their engines that they are looking for anything else they can possibly blame it on. So somebody's engine fails, and they come back and say, oh, no, look, we told you you shouldn't use synthetic. Oh, no, look, we told you you shouldn't have used a bypass filter. I don't think there's any truth to it. I think they're just looking for an out because they know their engine is likely to fail. They've had so many failures.
Yeah.
They've had so many problems with their cams, with their now with their fuel pump, their oil delivery to the bottom end of the engine, their oil filters clogging. They've had so many problems. They know they're going to have failures. They're getting killed with warranty work. And I think they're just setting up all of these other straw man arguments and saying, oh, no, it was this oil. It was that filter. It's not our fault.
But I'm living proof of this right now. I've almost got a million miles on this truck, and I've never done the engine.
Right.
I've done the top end sets, and I tell them to inspect the cam every time, or the cams. And I mean, this one's running great. Knock on wood.
Here's the other thing I would love to hear from them, and I can't find it anywhere. If you are telling me I shouldn't use synthetic oil in your engine, tell me why. Make it a logical, give me a logical reason, because I can't understand one. The oil only has a couple jobs. Oil is there to lubricate parts so that, you know, they don't touch. We don't get metal-to-metal contact. We have a film of you know, oil in between so we don't get wear. And it's there for some cooling capacity. The oil actually does some cooling, and that's why we have oil coolers and we watch oil temperature. It has that other function. Other than that, oil doesn't do much. So if that's all
that's
it
right.
does, and we know synthetic is a superior oil, then why doesn't synthetic work in your engine? Give me a logical reason why, and then maybe I'll believe it or understand it. But they don't. They just say we shouldn't use it. I hate answers like that. If you can't explain to me why, then how do you know?
Like, I'm not going to go with the really long extended oil changes because, I mean, even though I'll have the spinner and the OPS EcoPure on here, but I like to keep my oil clean. That's probably why this truck's lasting so long.
And you know what? We have other examples of that. Jackie, who calls the show all the time, runs an amazing business. She gets great fuel economy. I mean, she's done some really amazing things in the industry. She runs a much older truck. She's had the OPS on forever, and she loves it. But she still does, I don't know, 15 or 20,000-mile oil changes. I mean, she's not extending hers at all. She just loves the extra protection of the OPS and how clean it keeps. She still does her oil samples. But she changes her oil, and she can afford to, and it makes sense. So, yeah, if you want to do that, I think it makes total sense. You've got the synthetic in. It's not burning it. I can't for the life of me think of any reason why. Now, let me give you an example of a good reason why. If we go way, way back when synthetic first came into the market for heavy trucks, there were some issues with the seal material that were used in some engines, and the oil was not compatible with those seals. Now, that's a clear reason why. That makes total sense to me. Well, the industry figured that out. They create new seals. I get that. If I put this in and it starts eating away my seals and I get oil leaks, that would be a bad thing. If Cummins could explain to me some reason why we shouldn't put synthetic in their engine and it made sense, then I'd be on board. But I don't get it. We've been running synthetic in Cummins for decades.
Like, I've talked to some people that have tried synthetic in some of their Cummins, and they said that it really starts burning oil. That was a huge concern of mine from the start. But now that I've got it in here and there's over 12,000 kilometers on it, I've been checking the oil, and it depends exactly how the truck is positioned, but it's always staying right around that 4 mark. It just might be just a little bit under, or it might be just a little bit over, but it's not burning it.
Yeah, and that is a perfect example. And I've even told people, look, if we go to synthetic and you start burning a gallon every 6,000 miles, and we're going to be doing extended drains, that's not a bad thing, because now we put a fresh gallon in every 6,000 miles. It keeps the additives up, it keeps the oil a little cleaner, and we can go even further. You, on the other hand, you're not even seeing any increased consumption. So where could the downside be here?
I just can't see it.
I'm with you. I don't either.
Well, anyway, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yep, love to hear from you. Great stuff. Congratulations. Sounds like you've taken wonderful care of that truck, and it's paying off for you. I'm looking at the clock, and we're going to have to wrap this up and get out of here. Boy, these hour shows, we just blow through them. So many questions, so little time, but we will come back and do this again. In the meantime, if you have any questions we can help you with off the air, we have an amazing Tribe Care team just waiting to help you out. Give them a call, 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-385. Thank you. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, we're going to go ahead and do a second hour. We've got lots of questions right now, so we're going to get started. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, building a fleet. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone and give me a call. We'll talk about it here on the air. Some nights I've got a topic I'd like to open with, and other times I just like to get the phone calls and get to as many as we can. That's what we're going to do tonight. We are going to get started in Arkansas. Gerald, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with tonight?
Yeah, I got an oldest issue with my. All right, fan gauge right now is showing fluctuating between 15.4 and 15.8, and on the dash it's like at 15.2. But anyway, it a surge up into like 16 range, and then everything is shut down. The gauge is shut down, and it might pop back on, or it might just the truck doesn't shut off. And then it runs for a while, and then everything will pop back on. So random, I can't figure out what. I set my ground, back on my batteries, patting down everything back there. I do got a lot of extra stuff on here. I got the Maxwell on, got the Fast on, I got the OPS on. I got a lot of, it's just a lot going on.
Okay.
So,
what year and what make is this truck?
Oh, it's 03 Columbia, got a 12.7.
Okay, has a Now, this is clearly one of the hardest problems ever to troubleshoot. When we have an intermittent electrical problem that doesn't happen all the time or doesn't even act the same all the time, it really is the most difficult. You can waste a lot of money at shops that aren't good at this, and they'll keep trying stuff and never find it. Now, just because I know that it can be a problem and it can cause stuff like this, has anybody looked at the ECM port where you plug in a reader or you plug in the scan gauge?
I mean, the port on the inside of the truck where the scan gauge is plugged
yes.
in?
Yes. Yep.
No.
Okay, here's what happens on the Freightliners, and more so the older ones. You know, you've got the rubber cover that goes over that to keep dirt and water out, which is a wonderful thing, but that port has a problem where dirt and water gets in from the backside. And if the cover's on, it doesn't dry out, and it creates all kinds of corrosion. And then you start shorting across the wires in there, and it can affect everything in the truck, and nobody ever thinks to look there. Pittsburgh Power was the one that identified that as a problem. They had a truck that, my God, the guy had spent like $7,000 on troubleshooting. It had been to four different shops. Nobody ever figured it out. And when they got it in, they wired in a new ECM port, and it was done. Fixed every problem. So I can't guarantee that's what it is, but I would certainly look there. If that isn't it, if there's any way you can get to Pittsburgh Power with this truck, they are better at electronic troubleshooting than any other shop I know.
Yeah, I talked to Eric about a month ago. I'm trying to work my way back up there anyway, because I got a year on an M frame. They did M frame last year. I got 1.4 on it right now. Got a little over 100,000 on the M frame. Truck's going. I mean, everything runs good. I'm a fuel mileage great. Everything's good, and it's getting to the point. It's getting to the point where it's kind of like I'm scared they didn't let anybody touch the truck, because once they look at it and they see, well, you got all everything. You know, we got a lot of stuff on the truck.
Right.
They see a blue battery, they freak out. You know.
Oh, I know.
Now everybody's paranoid. Well, you got a lot of stuff on here, and it could, you know, so now I don't want you to touch it. But anyway, okay,
that's another good reason to go to Pittsburgh Power, because they understand all that stuff. They sell it, they service it, they install it, they get it. And they're just really good at electrical troubleshooting. So give them a shot. I think that's going to be your best bet. Go to South Carolina this time. Ron, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Kevin, for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is to basically get some information from the trucking industry. I'm not a trucker myself, but I have a patented product that's come out recently. We're in the testing stages, and somewhere around the first of the year, we should be able to start supplying a minimum amount of trucks on the road. It is a patented double alternator. Now, it's not two alternators side by side. It's two alternators in the same housing, working together, such as you would have like in a twin-engine boat or a twin-engine airplane, both the A and B side, working together to give you reliability in your electrical system. Since 1963, I guess it is, alternators become readily available, and they haven't changed a whole lot over the years. You know, they've gone from front fans to back fans to two fans and so on and so forth. But through the looking at a lot of the information available and going to a lot of the alternator shops and talking to them, I was able to, and myself, let me say first, the reason I got interested in it, I'm also a pilot and have my own airplane. I've had three alternator failures. So
if you got trouble
on the road, how about failures when you're at 5,000 feet?
Right.
So basically what it is, it's two brushed alternators working together, and instantly you got twice the amount of power. What the other people are doing in the industry, I'm talking about the big manufacturers, and as you well know, the trucks today are requiring more and more electrical power. But what they're doing is building all new products, starting with, let's call it almost a clean slate piece of paper, and just building a bigger alternator engine. You know, in your case, let's say going from an 8-liter to a 9 to a 10 to a 13 or whatever. Well, I have the luxury of being able to take two existing alternators that are reliable and Siamese them together, if you want to call it, and have an electrical reliability, you know, times two. So where someone's trying to put together a new 300-amp alternator, I'm taking two older 150-amp alternators and blending them together, and now you got the 300 amps, but you got the redundancy.
Got it.
So what I'm
that
asking,
makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And there's several more things that are involved here. I also have a patent pending on the airflow through the alternator, which cools it. The other thing is that I'm using outside ambient air instead of under the hood air whenever possible. So taking outside air, let's say at 90 degrees, compared to air that's under the hood as much as 180, 190 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm starting also 90 degrees cool air.
How are you getting that air into the alternator?
Just through a regular little air duct.
Okay.
The complete
design
of the alternator is somewhat sealed, and it only allows air from the outside to enter it in most cases. Also,
picture that on the truck. So I've got a standard alternator. It's only getting its air from the inside. I get it. The cooler the air, the better this is going to be. I put your alternator on. Where do I run that air duct? Do I have to modify my hood? How do I do that?
The easy way is just to find your location next to your radiator and pick it up next to the radiator.
Okay. Okay. And
you
supply
the
ducting and
basically it's regular ducting, and yes, I have that available. It's typically on a fair size alternator, it's gonna be like 2-inch ID.
Okay.
And then a little flange that you would drill a hole up next to your radiator through your radiator support area. Or if you had to, yes, you could put a NACA duct on it somewhere. And pick up the air there.
I get that. Okay, so I'm liking what I'm hearing so far. Let me ask you this, because it sounds like there's going to be two advantages here. One, I have the redundancy, which is a very cool thing. Two, the idea of bringing in outside air and cooling it better should extend the life of the alternator itself, correct?
Correct. And there's even a third thing.
Okay, what's that?
I also have available air filters to filter the air through it if it's a dusty or contaminated air type truck.
Got it. This all makes sense, and I always love this idea of taking a technology that's been virtually ignored all these years and saying, wait a minute, what could we do to make this better? I love that kind of stuff. So hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break, and I'm going to come back right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm talking with Ron in South Carolina about a cool new concept, I think it is, in alternators, which we've kind of ignored for years. You know, Ron, there's so many other examples of this that I love. One of them that comes to mind has nothing to do with trucks. We had vacuum cleaners for decades, and they were all the same. I mean, a couple different features, couple different looks, but everybody did the same thing. Dyson sat down and totally reinvented the whole market, and everybody copies him now. And that's kind of what's going on here. Or another good one for us, one of our current partners, Road King Shocks. Shock absorbers, the technology hasn't changed since the 1940s. And along comes Road King. They start all over. They design a much, much better shock. Sounds to me that's like what you're doing with Alternators here, and I like this. I do have one other question. So we know one of the disadvantages of our current system, you're driving down the road, you realize your batteries aren't charging right, your lights are starting to get dim, pretty obvious we've got an alternator problem, and the best we can hope to do is maybe limp into a shop and figure it out and get a new alternator. There was a time alternators were so unreliable, I used to just carry one with me. Because if it goes, it's not that hard to change. I'll just get out and change it. But that means I've got to carry it around. I've got to have the tools, you know, late at night, raining. So here's my question. I love the redundancy. If I'm driving down the road with your alternator and side A fails, do I know it? And how do I know it?
Well, it has two regulators. So you do have two regulator lights.
Okay, good. So
you're going to get an indication that you have, let's say, the front half, the A side, or the back half, the B side, has had a failure, and that you maybe need to call ahead and say, be prepared. When I get there, I want to change the alternator out or check it out.
But I still have, it, let's say in your example of a dual 300 total, I still have 150 amps, which is plenty to get me, you know, what I need.
Yeah, and that's a decision, Kevin, that the customer has to make or the company has to make, and that is, do I really need 300 amps? You know, could I get by with two 100-amp alternators where
right.
I've got 100
right.
amps reserved and I got 200 amps total, and maybe I got to shut down some extra features that I have? But that's a decision from the company or the individual. I can make alternators as large as they want.
Yeah, and that is an issue for me because sometimes people think, oh, well, I'll buy as much alternator as I can afford and I'll have more power than what I need. I think there's a huge downside to that. The bigger the alternator, the more it pulls off the engine and that energy has to come from somewhere and it will affect fuel economy. So I've always you've got to find the balance of I certainly don't want too little power, so I do want enough power, but I don't want too much either because then I'm just wasting a resource.
Well, Kevin, truthfully, you're not wasting that much, if at any, because the engine's only going to pull down based on the alternator requirements. The alternator pulling, let's say, 200 amps or 300 amps, figure about 4 horsepower, or at least gasoline horsepower, per 100 amps. That's kind of what I found out. So if you're pulling 200 amps, which is a heavy load, you're using about 8 horsepower. But if you back that load off and you're only pulling 50 amps, then you're only going to draw 1/4 of that horsepower. It's all relative.
Got it. Okay.
So, but in the case of alternators, in case you know you don't know it as much as I do at the moment, and I'm learning every day. Let's say the smaller the wire in the alternator, the better the performance. It will come online sooner, which means that it'll start charging at lower RPM. And if you're a truck with low RPM, that you run, let's say, lower RPM pretty much a lot or idle a lot, the smaller
right.
the wire, the better off you are. And in this case here, there's two features that you get. You'll actually get about 30% more power, which could relate into more efficiency, more fuel mileage. Now, I can't put a number on it, but by cooling the engine, by cooling the component parts, you're going to gain about 15 to 16% more amperage, not changing anything, just by running the component parts cooler because you get more energy.
Yep.
And secondly,
that all makes sense to me.
And then secondly here, in regards to the smaller wire, by having two 100-amp alternators with a total of 200, versus a 200 amp, you're going to gain about another 17% because the alternator comes alive much sooner.
Mm-hmm.
It'll come alive at, let's
yep.
say, 900 RPM. I'm talking about alternator RPM. Whereas
yeah.
if it's a bigger alternator, it's not going to come online until like 1,800 or 2,000 alternator RPM.
That makes
sense.
So
there's a huge
so
savings there.
Yeah. So now the next question. Let's say I decide 200 amps is plenty for me. I go out on the market and I price a 200 amp alternator. How will yours compare if I have the dual 100, same output? What are we looking at price-wise?
Well, to be honest with you, there is a huge difference between manufacturers and their price.
Right.
You can go out and buy a Delco 22SI online for $135. It won't be a Delco model. It'll be a Chinese-made. It's going to put
yeah.
out 135, 145 amps, and it's going to work for a while. Or you can go buy a Lees Neville or a Niehoff or some of the other high-end ones, and you'll pay 5 or 10 times more of that. So that's a problem we can't get our arms around. In other words, how are we going to price
well,
this thing? We know about.
Yeah, and pricing, I've been in business a long time. Pricing is probably the single biggest, you know, confusing problem everybody runs into. I get that. Just to give you where I come from and the kind of advice I give, I go out and buy the Lees Neville. That's what I've almost always stuck with. I've had great luck with them. Yes, you pay more for them, but in the long run, I pay less. So I'm okay. And our whole philosophy here on this show, we don't worry so much about upfront cost. As much as our show is all about saving money, I found over the years that the more money you try to save upfront, the more you end up spending in the long run. I'd rather invest in a better product upfront and save it over the long run. So if you
put yourself in
the middle or towards the high end of that price, I think you'd be fine. I think if you end up being the absolute premium product, you're going to have a tough time.
We do not anticipate being anywhere near the premium.
Okay.
But obviously, we're not going to be the same as buying one online.
No, and I wouldn't even want to see that. I mean, I wouldn't even want to get behind that. The little bit you're going to save up front just isn't worth it. I mean, in my book,
it just isn't worth it. I kind of throw out the scenario of a guy, let's say somebody leaving Raleigh, North Carolina with 10,000 chickens on Friday afternoon and halfway to St. Louis, the 99-cent diode goes out. And I said, there's going to be 10,000 chickens that are not going to be happy, or maybe they will be.
Yes. Yeah. No, I get it. So I love the idea. I love products like this. I love people who think like this. So I think you're onto something. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm glad you asked. What I have is I have a website that has more information about it. And on the website, there's actually a form that I'd like some of your guys to fill out and send in so that we can get a better feel as to what the industry wants. The
sure.
website is
you can do that.
The website is double-alt.com. I'll spell it. double-alt.com.
Got it.
The other unique thing, Kevin, is that there's the more we got into this, after I got it patented, the more I like it. Because it's two alternators in one, the one side could be 12 volt at 100 amps. The other side could be 36 volts at 200 amps. It doesn't care.
Ah, interesting.
Because you can take, let's say you got a communication truck where you need 28 volts, but you're putting on a 14-volt chassis. Yes, you partially lose part of your redundancy, but it's not hard to put a third regulator on there to make the 28-volt go back to 14 and have a relay or a circuit breaker that puts it back online for your chassis, so you can still get there as redundant.
So when you start thinking about this, it opens up all kinds of possibilities and combinations and permutations. I'd love that. So, Ron, stay in touch with us. I think there's more. Well, let me put you on hold. I don't want to rush it, but I've got to get to a break. We'll come back and we'll wrap this up right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go right back to South Carolina. Ron, go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's a lot I could talk about, but basically the unit itself could be used, you know, obviously in the trucking industry, which would probably be like the number one. But we're talking about transit. We're talking about military. We're talking about farm. We're talking about the refis. We're talking about boats. We're talking about generator sets. The list goes on. Any engine that has a rechargeable system with it, it would work.
I'm also very involved in the RV industry, and I own a big coach that we spend about 4 to 6 months out of the year in working, and I would be interested in the technology on that side, and certainly in trucking. So those are the two I could help you out with. And
Just to go along with that, Kevin, in the RV line, Prevost puts 4 alternators on their high-end unit.
Right.
4 of them, 2 for the chassis and 2 for the RV side.
Exactly. So,
instead of having 4, they could have 2.
Opens up all kinds of possibilities on that side. So here's what we could do for it. One, we got the website out over the air, and that's double-alt.com. Go there. There's a form, kind of a survey. We'll put it up on our Facebook page, but I'll also offer you something else, and we don't do this very often, but I have a couple organizations we work with. One of them is the North American Council for Freight Efficiency. It's a nonprofit group that is working on all kinds of new ideas around fuel technology and things like that. And when they want to survey the owner-operator world, they put a survey together. We actually send it out to all of our listeners. We have about 40,000 people in our email database. And again, we don't offer that to a lot of companies because I don't want to abuse that. But I love this idea, so we would be willing to work with you and send out the survey directly.
Well, I do appreciate anything, you know, along those lines. And I've had the patent for a while. I just recently have got the airflow patent registered with the patent office, waiting for a final on that. And I also got a third item out there, but we could talk about that another day.
Excellent. Let's do that. I'm going to put you back on hold. I'm going to have Brittany pick you back up, and we will get some information from you, and we'll get started on this process. I love the idea. Thanks for reaching out to us. Let's go to Ohio. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you doing this morning, Mr. Rutherford?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, to start with, Brittany and your group at Profit Gauges are just fantastic. Had a problem and called on Friday. They didn't—they couldn't answer it, but they said, we'll get Brittany to get back with you on Monday. And she sure did, and it was fabulous. But
excellent.
Saturday, I was
listening
to your show, and it's the first time I've ever heard you be as negative as you was, and I was got kind of down, and then I got to thinking about it afterwards, and it's like, you know, the owner-operators, that's the reason why I got into trucking, is to be an owner-operator. There's nothing that's going to deter me from that, but we are resilient, and if we had to, owner-operators could come together and make their own mega corporation, and that way we wouldn't have to go in as a fleet, and we could have our own brokers and do our own insurance, and, you know, through somebody like OIDA or something of that sort. And we would find a way to get around. And so I don't think the owner-operator, how you was talking on Saturday, is ever going to be the obsolete.
I agree with you. And I did get, and you're right, and you picked up on it. That probably is the most negative I've ever been. I think it's just this onslaught recently. And when I say recently, I'm going to lay it at the foot of the current administration that's in power. It just seems like the last 7 years has been turmoil. Regulation on top of regulation, but then we start a regulation, we change it. We put it on hold, we start. It's just making me crazy, and I agree with you. Entrepreneurs and owner-operators in this industry, they do it for a reason. They're not going to give up that easy. They're not going to give up at all. They're going to find a way to do this. What frustrates me is, I wish they could use that time and energy to providing value to their customers, which is what business is all about, instead of all this time and energy we have to waste trying to figure out how to get around this, the latest government regulation that makes no sense. But we will. So, yeah, I did get a little frustrated, but I'm with you. Owner-operators are going to be here for the long run.
Right. Now I got a technical question. I blew a compressor on. I've just been an owner operator 2 months, and I ended up blowing a compressor that I had. Would that have caused oil and water to get into my tanks, my air tanks?
Yep, absolutely.
How do I clean it out, and how do I get rid of that?
The best thing to do is literally pull the valves off the tanks themselves. Pull the lines off, pull the bleeder valves off, get as much access to the inside of that tank as you can, and then use a solvent and a flush. You're going to get, you know, since it's oil in there, we want to get something in like a good parts cleaner, something that's going to, you know, dissolve the oil itself, and then we're going to have to blow it out, clean it out. I would also grab, they're really inexpensive. If you go to like Harbor Freight, you can buy one of the inspection scopes, the lighted video. It's got a long flexible neck and a light. You'd stick it right in the tank and you can see what's in there. So then you clean it, flush it, inspect it again. But that's the way I would do this. Otherwise, if you try flushing anything through the system and then using the bleeder, you're going to chase it forever. This is one of those things where I think you're far better off to just pull all the lines and all the valves off the tank, clean it out, and be done with it.
Okay, so it won't have any residual in the lines. It'll be basically the tank itself.
You're going to have some residual in the lines, and that's, again, why I don't want to just try flushing the closed system itself. The bulk of it should settle in the tank, and if you get the tank nice and clean, then, and obviously you're going to replace the air dryer, and, you know, if you get the bulk of the tank clean, then you get a good air dryer in place, then it will be able to clean up the residual on its own.
Okay. That's what I was kind of thought that I had to do, but I wasn't sure, so just wanted to confirmation of it.
Yep,
thanks
there
very
you
much.
Go.
Appreciate
that's the way I would do it. You're welcome. Let's head off to Michigan. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Say, I got my question. We run one truck, just me and my wife, and we're getting ready to hire a driver. And so we got to use a W-2 form or whatever, so we got to set up this deal to send taxes in to the government or whatever. And I'm wondering if there's some advice on that. What's the easiest way? Like, I called Marcus over there, and of course they got a service that they do that at $60 a month, you know, but I'm wondering if it's something real simple that, you know, something we could just do ourselves and save that money or what.
It is something you can do yourself. It's not rocket surgery. The problem is it's dealing with government agencies. And that's where the frustration comes in, because for one employee, you've got to have state unemployment and federal unemployment. You've got to have state taxes if you are in a state with a state tax, or if the employee is in a state with a state tax. So now you've got, already, we've just barely gotten started, and you have three different agencies you've got to deal with. You've got to deal with a state tax office, a state unemployment office, and a federal unemployment office. Now you've got to figure out workers' comp, which is a state issue, and every state is different. Then we move on to Social Security and Medicare, and then we move on to federal tax. And I might even be forgetting something here. Maybe not. That might cover it all. But those are all different agencies, and you've got to deal with them first off to get the accounts set up. Then you've got to deal with all their forms for reporting. And it's not hard, but what happens is, you know, for a company like CLA, an accounting company, to do it for $60 a month. Well, for them, it's actually pretty simple because they do it every single day, and they do it for hundreds or thousands of clients. They know the systems really well. It's just second nature for them. And they can do it. $60 a month is pretty cheap. Wouldn't you say your time is worth at least $20 an hour?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to spend so much more than $60 a month in your own time. And then when something goes wrong, a form doesn't get where it's supposed to go, it doesn't get there on time, you got penalties, now you got to go fight them, and you're going to spend hours on the phone. It's not hard, but if you only do it for one person once a month, you will fight the system over and over and over, and you will waste a lot of time. So let me get to a break. I'll come back, and we can talk about it some more. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I go right back to Michigan. So, Jeff, that's some of it. Matt just reminded me of another issue, is that all these different agencies you're dealing with, they change their rates every once in a while. They change their rules every once in a while, and you don't always know that. If you're not really plugged into these things and paying attention, now all of a sudden your forms are wrong, and you don't even know why. I'm one of those guys that in business, I always try to do things myself first. Why pay somebody if I can figure this out and do it myself? I will tell you that when it comes to payroll and taxes, I gave up on that a long, long time ago. It is not worth the headache. It's not worth the chances of penalties and spending hours and hours on the phone with frustrating government agencies. I turn all of that stuff over to somebody else and let them do it.
Okay, I was wondering if you would, I mean, for 700 and whatever a year, you know, I thought to myself, for less the frustration, I thought it would be worth it. But if it, you know, I didn't know, I've never done it, so I thought, well, I'll throw it out there, see what you say, you know. So,
I've been through it all. I tried to do it myself. I did it myself for years. And finally, I looked at it and said, my God, why do I keep doing this? Why do I go through this frustration? Why do I get stuck on the phone for hours, redoing forms, paying penalties? So it was one of those areas where I can do it, but I don't want to. I just give it to somebody else.
Can I ask you another question? And I'm sure Marcus will steer me in the right direction on this stuff too. But we're just sole proprietors, and now we're moving into, you know, another truck and this driver or whatever. Is there at some point where we should do, like I hear all these people talk about incorporating that type of thing, is there some magic number where you should be that you should start thinking about doing that thing?
There is. And the magic number has nothing to do with how many trucks you have or anything else. It really comes down to just net revenue. Net meaning after we pay all of our expenses, after we deduct everything the IRS allows us to deduct, per diem, depreciation, all that stuff, are we paying tax? Are we paying self-employment tax on more than about $65,000 a year? And I don't care if that's one truck or 10 trucks. It really just comes down to the net revenue. And if you're paying tax on more than $65,000 a year, then there is an advantage to move into a corporation. And if you're working with Marcus, he'll go over all your numbers and show you all your options.
Yeah. And okay, yeah, we just started doing that. And, you know, I kind of figured that he would, but I just thought I'd throw it out there. So, okay, well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Sean in Idaho. Welcome to the program.
Howdy, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you
with? I got
today?
A question about fuel mileage. I have a 2015 Peterbilt 587. I have Super Singles. They're Michelins. I'm not entirely sure what Michelins they are. Our trailer, I pull a reefer. We're usually pretty heavy. And most of our newer, 95% of our trailers have Super Singles, and a lot of the new trailers have the trailer tails and side skirts. So basically with my operation, what should I expect? Because my fuel mileage is mostly right around 7.9, but I feel like I can do better, but I'm not really too sure.
You didn't tell me which engine.
It's the PACCAR MX-13.
Okay, that's going to be a problem, and let me explain why. And the engine may not be a problem, but trying to figure out fuel mileage might be. Let's just go back to before any real emissions, so 2003 and older. I've worked with fuel mileage for so long, it was kind of a challenge for me. I would have people call me, tell me their specs, everything, tires, you know, transmission, gears, all that stuff. Tell me about their operation, and I would guess their fuel mileage before they told me what it was, and I would usually be really, really close every time. And, you know, it looks very impressive, but it was just because I did it so much. And fuel mileage was pretty consistent. If you told me what was going on, I would know pretty much what the number was going to be. After emissions, 04, even just EGR alone, that got much more difficult. After DPF, it got even more difficult. After SCR, forget it. All bets are off. You have one truck like yours come out of the factory, you're getting 7.9 miles to the gallon. The one that rolled off the line right behind it, every spec identical, is getting 5.9. And nobody knows why. And I haven't been able to figure out why. We can't find any consistency. Even when we find the reason why, we'll find 15 different reasons why it happens. So this is one of the problems with all the new technology, is there is no consistency. These systems are so complicated. And sometimes it comes down to nothing more than an upgrade on the software and the ECM. Truck comes out of the factory, it's getting horrible fuel mileage. They do an upgrade on the ECM, it gets better. That's the simple, easy one. Other trucks, I've seen them put a million miles on them. We never figure out why they get such horrible fuel economy. So when it comes to the engine itself, I'm pretty hesitant to recommend much of anything. Now, there are a couple things. Put a fleet air filter on it. We can't go wrong there. Put a FAS on it, because even if it doesn't help our fuel mileage, it's going to be good for your injectors. But there's not much else we can do to that engine itself. So now we instead focus on the other things that don't have anything to do with emissions. So you've already talked about tires, but you don't know which one it is. Find out which one it is and find out what the rolling resistance is, because that is a slam dunk. It works on every single truck.
Go ahead.
I'm actually stopped now. I can sense. I'm looking at the tire.
Okay.
It's a Michelin X1 line energy.
Excellent. Good. So you've got really good tires. Yep, you've got really good tires for rolling resistance on the drive. We're fine there. And that's where we would focus. So you're good there. We would also look at what aerodynamic improvements can we make. So air tabs and flow below are two big ones. Again, works on every truck. I don't care what model, what year, what engine. We know you put on air tabs and flow below, we're going to see a fuel mileage improvement. Like I said, fleet air filter, that's kind of a slam dunk. Scan gauge. If you don't have a scan gauge, absolutely get a scan gauge on there because, again, that helps everybody in their driving habits. What else do we know for sure that always works? We can go to synthetic oil in the engine. We'll have some improvement there. The OPS will then it makes sense to have synthetic because we're not changing the oil all the time, so we can make some improvements there. Those are all really good places to start. That gives you quite a bit to work on. And, again, those are just kind of what we refer to as a no-brainer. We don't have to guess. We know they're going to work.
Okay. For my second question.
Okay.
This, as far as I know, I've never driven a Freightliner, but at least with this truck, I can drive all day, and by the end of the day, you've probably heard this 100 million times, I have lower back pain, shoulder pain, and neck pain, and I'm 21 years old. So
yeah,
that leads to a problem, being I'm so young.
Yep.
I know you recommend the Bose Ride, but I looked at the price for those things. They're like, what, $3,500?
Closer to five, unless they're running some big special right now. They're closer to $5,000. So there's no question. That is a huge investment. But I do look at it as an investment rather than a cost because you're already seeing some negative effects of this lifestyle, driving all day, and you're very young. Imagine what you're going to feel like when you're 50. And this
yeah,
is the
true.
Reason why the average male truck driver has a life expectancy, I've heard as low as 57. I've also seen a study where it says 61. Let's call it 60. But the average male non-truck driver lives to be 71. 11 years off your life because of this lifestyle? That's not a very good trade-off. So
no,
that's
really
horrible. So I would be making it a huge priority to do everything I can to be healthier. It's why we talk about, you know, diet. It's why we – the other thing I would recommend, and I know this isn't easy. I've been out on the road. I'm one of those guys that loves to get in the seat and put in 12 hours without stopping sometimes. That's just not healthy. So I have to fight against that. You need to get out of that truck every 3 hours and get out and walk for a quarter mile or a half mile and get back in, do some stretching, take up yoga. And I know none of these things are easy. But it's your health. Also, I would strongly consider the Bose Ride because there's just nothing else like it. The music's playing. I've got to get to a break. No, I've got to get out of here. That music means the show is over. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work. And master the journey. I'm Kevin Robinson. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us today, and we will be back here tomorrow, and we'll also be doing Destination Health tomorrow, so we'll see you then.